Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the state of American democracy and the durability of our democratic institutions, which are under attack by President Trump. Added to this, the traditional checks and balances provided by the Constitution's separation of powers no longer function because the Republicans in Congress are enabling Trump rather than curbing his abuse of power. Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, both professors of government at Harvard University, join us to discuss their new book, How Democracies Die, and their article at the New York Times, How Wobbly Is Our Democracy? We'll examine how durable our democracy is with rising political polarization in America that is racial and cultural, and assess the global retreat of democracy and the rise of authoritarian regimes as democracies in Turkey, the Philippines, Hungary, and Poland are under attack from the right, while democracy in Venezuela and Bolivia is under attack from the left. Then we will speak with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who was U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. We will discuss the demonstrations today across Russia against the lack of choice in the upcoming elections and Putin's latest move to silence the pro-democracy campaigner Alexei Navalny. Then finally, we'll look into the latest Taliban atrocity in Afghanistan with a suicide bomber using an ambulance as a bomb, killing 95 civilians. This following a recent slaughter at a hotel in Kabul and the murder of Save the Children aid workers in Jalalabad. Christine Fair, a former UN political officer in Afghanistan who is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor in the Security Studies Program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, joins us. We will discuss her latest article at The Atlantic, Pakistan Will Try to Make Trump Pay, and the ramped-up attacks on Afghanistan's divided government, which threatens to render America's investment in our longest war futile. And joining us now is Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, both professors of government at Harvard University. Stephen Levitsky's research focuses on Latin America and the developing world, and he's the author of Competitive Authoritarianism. And Daniel Ziblatt teaches Europe from the 19th century to the present and is the author of Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. Their latest book, co-authored together, just out, is How Democracies Die, and they have an article at the New York Times, How Wobbly Is Our Democracy? Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt.
Thanks for having
us.
And let me start with Stephen. Obviously, there's a certain amount of hyperbole in terms of the destruction that many people feel Donald Trump is doing to the United States. And after all, 65 million Americans did not vote for Donald Trump. And now there's a certain relief. I don't know whether the bar has been set low, but after Davos, there's a sense of some kind of normalcy returning, and people are anticipating the State of the Union as being less divisive than his previous speeches. So how would you assess the difference between concerns about undermining our democracy and the extent to which it has been undermined by Donald Trump?
Well, I think you're right that there was a lot of hyperbole initially, and for pretty good reason, right? We've never in the modern history of this country had a major party presidential candidate who is so blatantly abandoned core democratic norms, who called into question the legitimacy of our electoral process, who called into question the legitimacy of our independent media, who at times seemed to condone or advocate violence. This was unprecedented in modern U.S. politics. And so there was good reason to worry. I think the worst fears that were published in some work and were certainly talked about the fascism around the corner, that or the imminent breakdown of American democracy, I think those fears were not realized. I think that's to be expected because we do, in fact, have strong democratic institutions in this country. But there is damage being done on a number of fronts, and it's still early. We're 1 year into the Trump presidency. Daniel and I have studied democratic breakdowns in various parts of the world, and one thing that we learned was in many cases, it takes time. The erosion of democratic institutions can take 3, 5, even 10 years. So So I think it's too early to declare ourselves safe.
Well, surely, and let me ask Daniel this question. Surely, Daniel, we don't have what we normally should have in the way that the founders saw our democracy in terms of separation of powers. We don't have a functioning separation of powers at the moment. The Republicans are total enablers of Trump. But I see Trump as a kind of a weak, strong man. He may have authoritarian tendencies, but I don't think he has any kind of fascist ideology. I think his only ideology is himself. And it would seem to me that the real danger might well be that he is a weak president who people like the Koch brothers may well think is a perfect kind of president we want. He'll sign anything we put in front of him, and he'll give us a free hand. And by the choice of cabinet secretaries, it's pretty clear that he's doing the bidding of people like the Koch brothers.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think there's a lot of ways in which the ineptness of the president has made a lot of people feel better. And our checks and balances are generally working. I would say that, you know, the court system, media has played a kind of heroic role, I think, in highlighting abuses and potential abuses. So the thing that makes us worry, and we highlight this in the book, are really two things. I mean, one, a short-run kind of concern, and two, a longer-run concern. The short-run concern is what damage the presidency is currently doing on democratic norms. And so, you know, we really think that the checks and balances work in the U.S. because there are norms of mutual toleration and forbearance, which we elaborate these two norms in our book and also in the New York Times piece on Sunday today. So the point, though, that is that by undermining the legitimacy of elections, continuing to call into question, you know, whether elections are actually free and fair, and they're propagating the myth that there's election fraud, where many Americans now believe this. This is concerning. And similarly, questioning the neutrality of the media, and the presidency continues to do this while his first year in office. And this, many people don't trust neutral media anymore. So this is the kind of short run damage. But we also think that there's a deeper underlying problem that in many ways preceded Donald Trump and will probably outlast Donald Trump. And this has to do with the level of polarization in American society and growing kind of animosity between the parties, which makes our government increasingly dysfunctional. From a longer-term perspective, this is a really worrying trend, and we really think that this is something that we need to keep our eye on.
Well, Stephen Levitsky, I think in many ways you could make the case, and I know people on the left often use the word fascist loosely and refer to Hitler quite too often, but in terms of polarization, you could make the case that we don't have so much have Hitler, we have Goebbels in Fox News, the Pravda of the Republican Party. Today in Moscow, massive demonstrations right across Russia. And of course, Putin desperately wants the illusion of democracy. What they have in Russia is a managed democracy, which is something they also have in Iran. And
I think what they have in Russia is no democracy.
Well, yeah. But I think from Putin's point of view, he'd like to consider it a managed democracy. And what he's afraid of is that this boycott that Navalny's calling for is going to undermine the patina or the illusion that there's a democracy. So I guess I'm mixing two questions here. One is, my sense is that what has led to the polarization in this country are the kind of siloing of news and fake news versus real news, with Fox News basically capturing 35% of the population in a kind of bubble where they're immune to facts and evidence. That, I think, is what's driving the polarization. But what's your opinion?
We think that changes in the nature of the media, the rise of social media, and the rise of extreme partisan media, as you just pointed out, are an accelerating factor. They're a contributing factor. We don't think that they're the underlying cause of polarization. Countries, including our own, have been fully capable of polarizing themselves, polarizing themselves to the point of wrecking democracy without Fox News. We did it in the 1850s and early 60s. The Chileans did it in the early 70s. One doesn't need Fox News for intense polarization. We think that the fundamental cause of polarization has much more to do with realignment of our party system and a real intense segregation that is both geographic, racial, religious, and cultural. Without question, Fox News and the rise of social media in addition to that have exacerbated this, and there's good evidence for that. But we don't think it's the fundamental cause.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, both professors of government at Harvard University. Stephen Levitsky's research focuses on Latin America and the developing world, and he's the author of Competitive Authoritarianism. And Daniel Ziblatt studies Europe from the 19th century to the present and is the author of Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. The latest book together just out is How Democracies Die, and they have an article at the New York Times, How Wobbly is Our Democracy. And let me ask you then, Daniel, the second question that I addressed to Stephen, and that is, given the demonstrations today in all across Russia, the arrest of Navalny, the idea that in many ways, perhaps the most pernicious examples of democracy being rolled back around the world are these kind of managed democracies like you have in Russia, although Stephen said there's no democracy, but in terms of what Putin's trying to do, they seem to want to have legitimacy as well. In Iran, of course, they have the same kind of illusion of democracy, but essentially the powers behind the scene control everything. And certainly in terms of the media, which is what we were just talking about, state media in Russia today is not covering anything that's happening in the streets. And we do often see that with Fox News when there's a big breaking story from the New York Times. You don't even hear it on Fox News. So if you wouldn't mind addressing the first part, that is, are managed democracies even worse than more flagrant anti-democratic regimes?
Yeah, so that's a great question. One of the points which we develop in the book is, you know, really when we think of democracies breaking down, when most people think of democracies breaking down, they tend to think of military coups, tanks in the streets, generals coming to power. And that actually is a very apt description of how democracies broke down during the Cold War. That's how three quarters of democracies broke down, according to our calculations of this, during the Cold War. But since the collapse of communism in the early 1990s, the world has really changed, and democracy, and at least having elections, has been perceived really as the only way to, you know, organize a political system. So as a result of that, when democracies break down today, most democracies break down via elections, which sounds somehow contradictory, but, you know, if people come to power through elections, they can then, once in power, begin to chip away at the institutions of democracy. And so we see this, you know, throughout the world, and this has happened in Turkey, this has happened in Hungary, this has happened in Venezuela. You know, at Steve's point about Russia is that, you know, Russia, if it ever was a democracy, was very briefly, you know, in the mid-1990s. But, you know, very quickly, you know, Russia also, you know, continues to have elections and has a lot of the trappings of democracy. And that's really the key point here, is that lots of countries around the world have the trappings, the formal trappings on paper of democracy, while the substance of democracy is being eviscerated. And so, you know, how that evisceration takes place is something we can look to other countries around the world and see how that happens. And it happens exactly through the means that you're describing, you know, through control of the media. You know, one of the things that Viktor Orban did when he came to, when he was elected in Hungary, once he was prime minister, had a very large majority, he altered media laws. He changed the central body, created a central body that oversaw the regulation of media and tried to tilt the playing field really in his favor. And so this is what really happens. And I think this, as Steve noted, this kind of control of media does lead to polarization because of the kind of creation of like these parallel echo chambers. And so this polarization then empowers autocrats in power. So, you know, that this is something, again, you know, the U.S. is very far from this. We continue to have a vibrant, robust media, but this is certainly kind of the thing to keep our eye on.
Well,
if I could add one thing.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Fox News is actually the opposite of what you see in places like Russia, right? This is a government that, to a degree, is being run by Fox News as opposed to Fox News being run by the government. It's a very strange situation.
Right, it is. But I used to cover the Cold War and met a lot of Russian journalists, many of whom were with the KGB. But you always kind of felt sorry for them because they had to print the party line.
Right.
But we have a different situation here where we have a voluntary ministry of truth as opposed to a compulsory one. And I find that even more pernicious.
I agree with you.
So
I was just going to say one thing. Yeah, one thing, you know, so this, you know, you had mentioned Goebbels. I mean, we don't want to loosely and, you know, draw on analogies to Weimar and Hitler and so on. But, you know, in the late 1920s, a media mogul, a right-wing media mogul, you know, owned a chain of newspapers, and movie theaters, Alfred Hugenberg was his name, who really, you know, worked closely with Hitler. This was a way of shaping public opinion in a way that that was happening in the free marketplace of ideas, but in a way that made the society much more polarized than it would have been otherwise.
Well, the question I'd have, though, in terms of what's happening in this country is that in terms of what we're talking about, in terms of Fox being the kind of Pravda of the Republican Party, can you shame this situation away by saying, look, we're a free country, we pride ourselves in our democracy and our freedom, and we've never had a kind of ministry of truth in this country. And I would tie this into what I find extraordinary at the moment, where the Republicans are attacking the FBI and the Department of Justice. The party of law and order is now undermining the number one police force in the country, which is very strange. And the extent to which Republicans are making excuses for Putin and siding with Trump in denying that there's any connections there when there clearly are, the extent of them, of course, we don't know until the Mueller inquiry comes out. So this is what I find troubling is, how do you use the sort of continual mythology of American democracy as a weapon to basically warn those that seem to be readily abandoning our democracy, or at least not adhering to it, and cozying up to a foreign dictator?
I think that's probably something we need to do more. I'm not sure that we've used the very successful mythology, and also the real strength of many of our democratic institutions, including the press, including the judiciary, to in fact shame the Republicans and to shame the Republican base into abandoning. The Republican base is in a place right now where Vladimir Putin has a much higher approval rating among Republicans than Hillary Clinton. The Republican Party is sliding into a kind of extremism that is bordering on authoritarianism, and I don't think anybody quite has a single bullet answer for how to resolve that, how to change that course, but it's extremely dangerous.
And I would just add to that I mean, one of the purposes of our book is to identify the strategies that electoral authoritarians use. And so, you know, we lay out in the book, you know, that what often happens is once elected, electoral authoritarians try to capture the referees. They try to tilt the playing field. They try to go after their opponents. So we kind of lay out a kind of step-by-step, you know, in a sense, a playbook, that one can see. And so part of our purpose is to allow readers to kind of look around the world and to sort of, you know, there's a lot of messy events, breaking news headlines. It's hard to sort out what's important, what's not important. And the idea is just to kind of have us in mind, like, what's happened in other countries. Not to say that the U.S. is directly following the path of other countries, but to have some kind of baseline of comparison. It's our goal, you know, to try to get our book widely read. And this is one way, this is our way of trying to alert citizens as to what's happening. And, you know, that's our small contribution to this problem that you've identified.
So one of the factors, though, and you mentioned this in your New York Times article today, How Wobbly Is Our Democracy, that explains this polarization, particularly on the Republican side, is how the demographics are changing in this country and how the Democrats are becoming, that both parties were white parties, Republicans and Democrats, but recently, in the last few decades, the Democrats are becoming more and more a Latino African-American party and the Woman's Party, I guess. That seems to be the coalition. There's also obviously racism involved in the drift to the right in some of these countries that were sort of temporary democracies like Poland and Hungary, where xenophobia about Muslim immigrants is something of a rallying cry for Orban and the Polish leader as well.
Even though those countries don't have very many Muslim immigrants.
Exactly. They don't. Exactly. And Germany, of course, has them. And there's a battle within Germany and the rise of the right wing there. So how do you explain racism being both a factor in this country and also a factor in the rolling back of democracy, particularly in Eastern Europe?
Yeah, no, I mean, so one of the, you know, we really think polarization is a driving force, as Steve has said, of the kind of growing fragmentation and precariousness of democracy in the United States and also elsewhere. But the sources of polarization vary. I mean, we mentioned Chile. Chile was a country where they had polarization over the Cold War. You know, today that's a very different dynamic in the United States. And what we see in the United States is, you know, really beginning in the 1960s with the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, which made America for the first time really a full democracy. You had three trends really taking place. You had the migration of the Southern Democrats to the Republican Party. You had the creation of, blacks were enfranchised and went to the Democratic Party. And a new wave of immigration as a result of immigration reform who tended to vote for the Democratic Party. And so you have now in the United States these two parties, one essentially a white Christian party, the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party, a very diverse party. And so this is in many ways you have two very different communities, and this is the source of polarization. And, you know, what role this is playing in Eastern Europe, I mean, I think, you know, similarly, I think in Poland, religion plays a major role. These kind of questions of identity, and even if there's not many migrants, the kind of fear of migrants is a big part of this and whatnot. So, you know, it's not just normal polarization over kind of economic issues and healthcare and taxes. When polarization centers around these kinds of, you know, fundamental questions of identity, who we are as a people, And if citizens feel that their country in some way is being transformed right in front of their eyes in a fundamental way, this turns into a kind of existential threat. And so people begin to perceive, we think incorrectly, that they are, you know, the country is fundamentally changing in a way that's not going to benefit them. And so they resist this. And so that's really the kind of dynamic that we're describing in the U.S. And I think a similar thing is happening elsewhere in the world. Steve may have some more to say on this, I think.
Well, let me ask Steve, though, a slightly different question, and that is the other threat to democracy, it would seem to me, is whether or not we are still a democracy and are heading in towards some kind of plutocracy. And this seems to be an inexorable global trend, if you will. The recent Oxfam report, I think, is something like 8 billionaires have half the world's wealth. And we seem to be heading into a kind of new global feudalism where you have a vast underclass peasantry. You have a small managerial class of wealth managers, accountants and lawyers, and then you have a handful of extremely wealthy multi-billionaires. What's driving that trend, and how much do you think that is a fundamental threat to democracy, given that we were talking earlier about the extent to which perhaps the oligarchs in this country are perfectly happy to have a weak strongman in the White House, Donald Trump, who'll sign anything they put in front of him?
Right. No, it is a great threat to democracy. I don't think any of it is inevitable. It is in large part a result of policy choices. And here, I think a lot of the responsibility lies with center-left parties across the West over the last quarter of a century. What may have been a sort of politically necessary move to the center at the time, whether it was Blair in the UK or Clinton in the United States, the party that is supposed to fight for the little guy, the party that is supposed to, or that historically had taken seriously issues of inequality and fought for redistribution, basically gave up for a quarter of a century. And so these are policy choices that are driving higher and higher levels of inequality. Now, the impact that inequality has on politics, on democracy, is not necessarily direct. In other countries, and certainly in Europe, there is a little bit more of a buffer between economic inequality and political inequality because of much more significant campaign finance regulation and the role of public financing, and in some countries, public media. In the United States, it's very privatized, and particularly since the Supreme Court ruling of 7 years ago, the tremendous influence of money in politics allows inequality to translate very quickly into political inequality. And voters are feeling that. Voters, not just in the United States, also in Europe, but voters are feeling the gap between themselves and who they perceive to be the elite. And that is one of the things that fuels populism. In some cases, it's left-wing populism. In some cases, it's right-wing populism. But populism tends to be pretty destructive of our institutions. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out of perceptions of unfairness and perceptions of inequality.
Well, just in closing, let me ask both of you to sort of sum up, and indeed you point out that the two basic indicators of democratic health are mutual toleration, and the second norm is forbearance, self-restraint in the exercise of power. And obviously, we celebrate the world's oldest and most enduring democracy, but it did have a major threat from within with the Civil War. And we're talking in terms of our democracy being under threat, and so many around the world, both on the left and the right, with Venezuela being rolled back, and on the right, Poland and Hungary, etc. So I don't want to leave us with some despair, but at the same time, maybe asking too much for both of you to tell us how we're going to reverse this, and particularly focus on those, reinforcing those two basic pillars of democracy, mutual toleration and forbearance. Let's start with Daniel.
Yeah, so yeah, the question of what to do about this situation is really obviously the thing that's on people's mind. And, you know, one of the things we've done is identify, name, highlight these problems with the idea that this does lead to action of citizens and politicians. Some of the things we've thought about and we develop more in the book are, you know, there's things that Democrats can do and there's things that Republicans can do. You know, we think the Republicans need to become a more multicultural party and as a way of reducing the kind of polarization that we're facing today. But the things that Democrats can do is, you know, there's a lot of suggestion today that Democrats need to begin to fight like Republicans, and to kind of abandon the forbearance and, you know, kind of carry out more scorched earth kind of politics, government shutdowns, filibusters, impeachments as regular politics. I mean, under certain circumstances, this kind of politics might be necessary, but we really warn against that. So what we think is that what Democrats need to do is to fight robustly and in a muscular kind of way, but in a way that reinforces our norms. Because what we're really afraid of is, you know, one party has begun to abandon the democratic norms. Democrats think, you know, there's signs that Democrats may as well. You know, there may be a push to, you know, if Democrats take back the U.S. Senate, if President Trump names a nominee to the Supreme Court, they may refuse to seat the or to even have a hearing, hold hearings for a nominee in the same way what the Republicans did to the Democrats. And so this is the kind of thing we really think Democrats need to fight in a way that is norm reinforcing.
And Stephen, a last word from you.
Just very briefly, I think it's important that we not take democracy for granted. I think one of the problems here, paradoxically, is our democracy has been so successful and is so old that American politicians, American citizens take it for granted. We don't believe that we can wreck our democracy. And I think the first step is realizing that how we behave, the abandonment of these key norms of toleration and forbearance, can be very, very costly. And I think once at least we realize that the stakes are very high, that we could do great damage to our democracy, then politicians perhaps will start thinking about behaving in a more responsible way before it's too late.
Well, I thank you both for joining us here today, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, both professors of government at Harvard University. Stephen Levitsky's research focuses on Latin America and the developing world, and he's the author of Competitive Authoritarianism. And Daniel Ziblatt studies Europe from the 19th century to the present and is the author of Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. And their latest book, co-authored, is just out, is How Democracies Die. And they have an article at the New York Times, How Wobbly Is Our Democracy? And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into demonstrations across Russia against the lack of electoral choice.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Armed Control Initiative, who served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Councils. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the demonstrations across Russia today, of course, the police detained Alexei Navalny, who branded this boycott of the upcoming March 18 elections in Russia for a fourth term for Vladimir Putin, which is all but certain. This happened in 8 degrees below zero Fahrenheit weather. Not as many people, of course, turned out, but there were some 115 events across the country. And to my mind, you just have to admire the Russian people, you know, who basically they have a managed democracy, is what Putin calls it, or what they like to see it as, and it certainly is managed, but it's really pretty much democracy is dead in Russia, is it not?
Yeah, it's been managed to the point where you did see demonstrations in a number of cities across Russia that were permitted. However, the demonstrations in Moscow and St. Petersburg, the two largest cities of Russia, those demonstrations were not permitted, so that's why we saw arrests in those two places. And I think that reflects the fact that the Kremlin is nervous about support for President Putin, particularly in large cities. I mean, outside of large cities is where Putin's base is, but there's a certain nervousness about feelings in Moscow and St. Petersburg.
So what is the breakdown then? You've got the so-called Narod in the countryside that has always been sort of fairly, I'm trying to think of a polite way of putting it, but they're sort of susceptible to authoritarian figures, and that's been the history of the country for some time, for most of its history. But then you've got this educated urban professionals. And my sense amongst the young ones who are demonstrating, in particular, is that they just feel that the Siloviki, these crony capitalist crooks that have stolen the country blind, basically have stolen their future. What is the uniting kind of force, do you think, amid this opposition?
Yeah, no, I think there is a certain frustration, and increasingly you're seeing it in the fact that more younger people are taking part in these demonstrations, a frustration that the average Russian person has no real say in the country. So the Russian election, the presidential election, is still a month and a half off, but nobody doubts that the winner is going to be Vladimir Putin. The only question is what percentage of the vote will he win? But this is where I think the Kremlin perhaps made a mistake, is that by excluding Alexei Navalny, who Paul Scholz was only going to poll a couple of percent. I mean, he would not have been a serious challenger to Putin. I think the strongest challenger to Putin right now polls only about 6 to 7%, and Putin's up in the 50% to 60% range. But Navalny is now calling for a boycott of the election, and in a way, that may be a bigger threat to the Kremlin, because if people assume that Vladimir Putin's going to win the election, why go out? If people are frustrated, and Navalny encourages that, and you hear reports that what the Kremlin would like to see is Putin win with 70%, and my guess is he will poll at least 70%, but they would also like to have a turnout of 70%, which is a bigger turnout than Putin got 4 years ago. And if you have a lot of Russians simply staying home, will people see that as a lack of confidence in Mr. Putin? Does that somehow weaken the mandate that he hopes to secure in the March election?
And he's got this this woman, the daughter of his former political mentor, Sobchak, running. And nobody takes her seriously, right? I mean, already he's got token opposition, which seems to be completely cynical.
Yeah, I mean, there really are sort of three main candidates running against Mr. Putin. One would be Vladimir Zhirinovsky. He's the head of the Liberal Democratic Party, a party that's neither liberal nor democratic, and usually, in fact, votes with Mr. Putin's party in the Russian parliament. He's polling at about 6 to 7%. The Communist Party actually replaced their candidate from the last four elections. They have a gentleman by the name of Pavel Gudinin running. Again, polls show he's going to get about 6%. And then you have Ksenia Sobchak, who's the daughter of the former mayor of St. Petersburg, for whom Mr. Putin worked when he was in St. Petersburg about 25 years ago. But her polling numbers are, about 1.5%. And most don't really take her as a serious candidate. So there really is no doubt that Mr. Putin's going to win. The concern in the Kremlin now is, does he win with sufficiently high numbers, both in terms of the percentage that vote for him, but also in terms of the turnout that legitimized the election that gives him a mandate?
So how much is the fact that Russia has managed to work with OPEC basically cut back on oil supplies in order to drive the price up? And now we got oil around $70 a barrel. I think for Putin, he'd like it at around $100 a barrel, but it's certainly up from, the low of about 30. What's your sense of we have the same situation here, in effect, where in spite of Donald Trump's manifest lack of qualification to be president of the United States, he may well get the Republicans may retain the House and Senate, and he may get reelected simply because, as James Carville famously said, it's the economy, stupid.
Well, the economy is important, but the price of oil has gone up, and that's important for Russia because a huge part of the Russian gross domestic product depends on exports of oil and natural gas. So when energy prices are high, that's good for the Russian economy. But still, in 2017, the Russian economy grew, but it was less than 2%. I think most economists said about 1.5%. And most economists looking out over the next several years are talking about a Russian economy that's likely to continue to have anemic economic growth at best. And one of the problems that the Russians have is, as the price of oil goes up, of course, for other producers like non-conventional producers in the United States, they now have incentives to bring more wells online. And so very few people that I've seen are talking about the price getting back up into the $100 range that Mr. Putin would like to see. And you don't really see, to the extent that Mr. Putin's running the campaign, he hasn't been emphasizing the economy much. It's been more talk about Russian nationalism and then Russia's return on the world stage as a great power. And that reflects the fact that I think Mr. Putin understands that the economy is not a strong selling point. So he's looking to other themes in terms to justify what his time as president has produced in the last 4 years.
So that guarantees anti-Americanism all the way through March 18, right? That's the main platform, isn't it? Glavny Protivnik, yeah. The main enemy.
Well, certainly we've seen that, and this goes back really to 2011 when he announced that he was running for the presidential election in 2012, was as part of this idea, this appeal to Russian nationalism, and Russia is a great power. He has positioned Russia rhetorically as an opposition to the United States. That has been a pretty consistent theme that he's hit home on the last 5-6 years. And given the absence of really good news on the economic front, he probably doesn't have much incentive to change that theme.
So there's some interesting stories, which I'll be covering later, broken by Dutch newspapers, that the Dutch intelligence services apparently set up an operation right next door to the GRU's Cozy Bear operation just off Red Square, and were basically able to read their mail, and they have evidence in real time of all the Russian hacking that went on, particularly with the DNC. So things are heating up on that front. How is it playing in Russia? Because it's obvious that, as a former KGB colonel, Putin, the idea, when Trump keeps saying there's no collusion, he's probably right, because if you're running an intelligence operation, you don't want to have your fingerprints on it. But that doesn't mean that you're working Trump and the Americans and people like Jill Stein of the Green Party as what the KGB used to refer to as useful idiots.
Yeah, I think in Russia, probably their satisfaction with the campaign that they conducted to interfere in the U.S. presidential election in 2016, it's hard to know for sure. My guess is that their primary goal was to create confusion and a little bit of chaos and basically to undermine Americans' confidence in the legitimacy of the American electoral process. Now, some have suggested the goal was get Trump elected. I'm less sure about that one. But it's interesting in that in November of 2016, in the aftermath of the American presidential election, you saw a lot of very happy people in Moscow. And because they had looked at what Donald Trump had said on the campaign, he had talked about improving relations between Washington and Moscow, something that I also support. But Mr. Trump never said that in order to get to a better place in U.S.-Russia relations, Moscow had to correct some of its disturbing behavior, such as its aggression against Ukraine. He talked on the campaign trail about perhaps easing sanctions on Russia. He talked about perhaps recognizing the illegal annexation of Crimea by Russia. So there were some expectations in Moscow that with Donald Trump in the White House, you'd see a new American reset in ways that would be very much favorable to Russian interests. That hasn't happened. In fact, what you've seen over the last year is a fairly mainstream Republican approach to Russia, which is pretty wary of Russia. It supports Ukraine. It supports NATO. You've seen some intensification of sanctions, in part because Congress took action last summer out of concern that the White House might not be prepared to stick to the sanctions on Russia. So from the sense of those who 14 months ago were celebrating in Moscow about the election of President Trump, I think there's a pretty significant degree of disappointment now because they haven't seen the change in American policies that they wanted to.
Well, just in closing, though, Russian bots and troll farms are being used to promote, for example, this Republican line about this conspiracy within the FBI. They also interfered in the recent shutdown of the government by their troll farms and bots pushing out Schumer shutdown hashtag. So what explains, just in the last minute, what explains why so many people on the Republican side, and particularly in Congress, like Devin Nunes, why are they doing what they're doing?
I do not understand that at all. I mean, I completely understand why Russian bots are pushing out lines of attack the FBI, because if you're in Moscow, why wouldn't you want to undermine the credibility of the FBI and the American people? What I don't understand is why the Republican Party is pursuing that line. And I think it's potentially dangerous, 5 or 6 years down the road, if the American people have no confidence in institutions like the FBI and the Department of Justice, the finger's got to be pointed back at what the Republican Party has been doing the last 6 or 8 months.
Well, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and Special Assistant to the President, and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the ramped-up attacks by the Taliban could render America's investment in our longest war futile.
چشمان مست سیاهت مبند نازنی نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار با بس بگو جلوهایت فروشی و چند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor in the Security Studies Program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan in Kabul, and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute of Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And she served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, and her research focuses on political and military affairs in South Asia, that's Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. And her most recent book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. And she speaks and reads Hindu, Urdu, and Punjabi, and has an article at The Atlantic, Pakistan Will Try to Make Trump Pay. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thanks for having me again.
And there's been, of course, the series of hideous attacks by the Taliban in Jalalabad against the Save the Children. And then prior to that, of course, the hotel was attacked and people were slaughtered there. And now, of course, this ambulance uses a bomb, killed 95 civilians in Kabul. But this seems to be ramping up. And my understanding is that the government of Ashraf Ghani is somewhat paralyzed. They seem to be in a political war with the governor of the Kabul area as well. So let's start with the political divisions within Pakistan. Within Afghanistan. Are there, again, the Afghans their own worst enemies?
Well, pushing it a Freudian slip, because the country behind these attacks is certainly Pakistan, but to address your question, there is a problem of government legitimacy in Afghanistan. You may recall that the presidential elections were riven with fraud, and the Americans intervened to try to resolve this impasse. The supporters of Abdullah believed that he had won the election, and of course, Ghani claimed that he had won the election. So the Americans connived to set up this extra constitutional structure whereby Ashraf Ghani would be the president and Abdullah would be the chief executive. Now, what this effectively did was that the president and the chief executive had to divvy up the various patronage pools amongst their various supporters. And so this caused, significant divisions as each appointed their own loyalists to particular positions in different provinces. And so you would have, one faction in charge of the Ministry of Defense and another faction in charge of the Ministry of Interior. And of course, while much of the insurgency is clearly supported and driven in every serious dimension from and by Pakistan, the insurgents wouldn't have such an easy time operating if the Afghan government itself were functioning legitimate and cracking down on corruption, which Ashraf Ghani had an entire organization prior to becoming president called, Fixing Failed States. He knows what he needs to do, but he's been unable to do it.
Well, let's then turn to the Freudian slip, Pakistan. And recently, of course, Donald Trump broke the tradition and basically said, enough already, we're sick of your duplicity and we're going to withhold funds. And as your article in The Atlantic, Chris Fair, mentions, that Pakistan will try to make Trump pay. Is that what's happening, that these ramped up attacks are orchestrated by Pakistan as a way to remind the U.S. that we have to continue to treat them as being too dangerous to fail?
So, that's my interpretation. Look, so as someone who has long advocated stricter policies against Pakistan, and I would even advocate a stricter aid cutoff than that advanced by President Trump, what I think people need to understand was that this was not part of a well-thought-out strategy. And I know that's probably going to come to many of your listeners as a surprise that President Trump did not have a well-thought-out strategy. We are essentially dependent upon Pakistan for access to Pakistan's airspace that is how we are primarily resupplying American troops in Afghanistan. And we are also dependent upon Pakistan's ground space. That's how we are resupplying the Afghan National Security Forces. I know for a fact that this administration has not worked out alternative air and ground routes. And until we are in a position to do that, Pakistan still holds many of the cards. The previous Obama administration had made really important advances with Iran. And people may not know, in 2001, Iran was a very important partner of the Americans in trying to bring some early stability to Afghanistan. Unfortunately, President George Bush reviled Iran as part of the axis of evil. And we really lost a lot of the momentum that was happening between the U.S. and the Americans in Afghanistan. So where we were with Obama was that you could imagine moving at least the supplies for the Afghan National Security Force through Iranian soil. The Indians have been over several years building a port in Chabahar. With the Iranians, they've also connected that port with rail and road links into Afghanistan. But until we have these alternative routes, logistics is going to trump every strategy. So Pakistan knows that it has us where it wants us. And rather than closing these air and ground routes, Pakistan has responded to Trump's vituperation in ways that I think are largely asymmetric. It's using his own rhetoric on Afghans being potential terrorists as an excuse to oust Afghan refugees. This has become a problem for Afghan managers. And then, of course, as you noted, it's escalating these Taliban and Haqqani-backed attacks.
But just in the broader sense, though, for the life of me, I cannot understand why. I mean, I understand that Pakistan's strategy of basically shaking the U.S. down for money, basically on along the lines that the country's too dangerous to fail, even though they do apparently little to nothing about curbing the growths of radicalism with their own Pakistan Taliban. And I spoke recently with a former U.S. Ambassador, Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S., Hussein Haqqani, who basically said as long as the military are taking all the money and you're not spending money on education, Pakistan is going to be a tinderbox. So that's one issue. But then why is it that the ISA, the military in Pakistan, want to destabilize Afghanistan using these proxies like Haqqani and the Taliban? And I can't imagine they're involved with the Islamic State. But at the end of the day, what good would it do Pakistan to have Afghanistan next door as a terrorist haven?
So they may very well be involved with the Islamic State. That's a very complicated issue that it will take a while to explain. But don't write off Pakistan involvement, at least with the Islamic State in Afghanistan. The Islamic State in Afghanistan is not what we think of. It's not Islamic State, Syria, and Iraq. It's not even clear what ties the Islamic State in Afghanistan has to that main center of IS activity. Most of the Islamic State in Afghanistan are actually Pakistani. And the ISI understands that in parts of the country where the Islamic State is operating, that they've sort of outplaced the Taliban. So it would be foolish of the ISI to not cultivate the Islamic State in Afghanistan for operations. But going to your larger question, what Pakistan has always been afraid of is that India will have a robust presence in Afghanistan and that it will take advantage of the Indian-Afghan relationship to destabilize Pakistan's western border. And these fears go back to some of the earliest years of the state. It's driven Pakistan's policy of strategic depth. So from Pakistan's point of view, there's only one thing worse than a stable Afghanistan. It's actually a stable Afghanistan with good ties to India. So from Pakistan's point of view, it would much rather have an unstable Afghanistan, the violence in which it can calibrate, than have a stable Afghanistan with solid ties to India. And so this has always been Afghanistan's strategy. There's this myth that the Americans, for example, began the jihad when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1979 on Christmas Day. That's actually a myth of epic proportions. Pakistan began doing this as early as 1974, before the Americans even thought about supporting Pakistan in its efforts. So this has been a very long-standing part of Pakistan's strategy. It's been a very long-standing component of the strategic culture of the Pakistan Army.
Well, but let's assume, for example, that the huge investment that we've made in America's longest war will end up being futile, that the situation just gets worse and worse, that this divided government and all the corruption, et cetera, and it's obvious that a few terrorists can destabilize. You know, we've seen terrorist attacks in Europe, how they paralyze entire countries. So it's pretty obvious that this could go so much worse, and eventually you could end up with this roiling terrorist haven like they had before 9/11, it's even worse. What good does that do to anybody, let alone the Pakistanis? That's the part that I don't get. I understand their strategy, but this is like having, you know, a pit bull that you keep taunting, and one of these days it turns on you.
You do know I'm the mama of three pit bulls, and that's not how it works. Okay.
All right. I'm sorry to mention that. Okay.
Yes, we can talk about other dogs, but we can't talk about pit bulls in this way. They suffer enough brutality and misperceptions. Let's not foster that further. No, I know it sounds really difficult to understand, but from Pakistan's point of view, it is capable of riding this tiger, and it is riding a tiger. From Pakistan's point of view, The parts of Pakistan that have experienced insecurity is a part of Pakistan that Pakistanis really don't care that much about. Since about 2009 or 10, I think largely thanks to the U.S. drone program, the Pakistani Taliban have really been unable to execute the kind of attacks that they had done in 2009 when they were ravaging Lahore, Islamabad. They were taking on very significant targets in the Pakistan military and intelligence. They've been pretty much degraded to largely killing civilians. Mostly, they've been conducting sectarian attacks against Shia, for example, the Shia Hazara in Balochistan, Ahmadis, and some minority attacks. So from Pakistan's point of view, this is very well worth the price. And this is something I think it's very difficult for people to understand. Mm-hmm. Pakistan has, you know, very low regard for Afghan life. It has low regard for Indian life. And it even has low regard for many of the lives of its own citizenry that it's completely willing to sacrifice to this strategy,
right,
because it believes that these strategies are important to Pakistan's survival.
Well, Christine Fair, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. And be kind to pit bulls, Ian.
I will. I'm sorry. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor in the Security Studies Program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Her latest book is Fighting to the End, Pakistan Army's Way of War. And she has an article at The Atlantic, Pakistan Will Try to Make Trump Pay. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.